Greetings. Welcome. Bienvenidos. Hola, aloha. Ni hao. Namaste. Konnichiwa. Bonjour, buongiorno. Sawadikarap. Guten tag. Jawi viva catbang. Half a day. Jai Janendra. Salam. Shalom. Peace. Now, go vegan. Peace how? Go vegan. From the left coast of the unlabeled, genetically mutated McNugget Pharmaceutical Vivisection Prison Kilitary Industrial Core Poor Nation. In the cheese-covered post-constitutional bankster bankrupt corruptocracy-mocracy criminocracy of the United States of Listeria, foodborne in the NSA, NRA, USA, home of Uncle Sam Manella, where they sure do eat a lot of dead animal body parts, and the Wall Street-backed corporate diet of death, disease, and destruction is shoved down your throat. This is Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Broadcasting now for over 12 years, as heard on Air America, CBS and Clear Channel radio stations, and now nationally syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network, which considers this program its first food show. Now, I really never, over the 12 years, I never really thought of this as a food show, but, you know, I thought, well, animal liberation show, a health show, an environmental show. For example, I think that I have satirized Al Gore countless times related to the environment for what had been a truth too inconvenient for even him. He who both single-handedly invented the worldwide interweb net and alerted us to the dangers of climate change, and then conveniently avoided telling us the solution for climate change. Okay, Al, you have us all scared, poopless. What can we do? Well, demand a recount? What do we do, Al? And on air, I did say Al Gore didn't win the Nobel Peace Prize. He won the No-Tell Please Prize. Because, well, it's too inconvenient for those still addicted to the taste of flesh and blood and animal excretions and secretions to recognize that the solution for climate change is for us all to go vegan. If Al Gore would tell us all to go vegan to stop climate change, I mean, well, then he would have to do it himself. If Bill McKibben of 350.org were to tell us to go vegan, well, flesh-eating, meat-eating Bill McKibben would have to do it himself. Well, the Washington Post reported this past week that, without fanfare, Al Gore has gone vegan. Usually when you go vegan, there's no fanfare, so you don't have to worry. It's not an unusual case. I didn't really have much of a horn section around when I made that decision coming up on 30 years ago. The truth has finally become convenient, and Al Gore has finally, well, he's given up the gore on his plate, you know, and he's finally become an environmentalist. Who knows, maybe he heard last week's episode of Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden and heard about all the fantastic vegan alternatives to eating turkeys. Maybe Al was standing in front of his mirror, playing president, thinking, you know, maybe I would need to lose a few pounds to make the Air Force One weight load limit. Maybe he pretended to pardon that Thanksgiving turkey. Or maybe he just said, well, how can I go on talking about climate change and not be a vegan when animal agriculture is responsible for at least 51% of all human-caused greenhouse gas emissions? And, well, grass-fed animal eating is an environmental disaster, too, so that's not an option. Well, too bad Al didn't come to this convenient truth back in 2000. Maybe there would have been better blood flow to the brain. Maybe he would have been clear thinking enough to have demanded a proper recount, and we would have been spared, whew, well, you know, whew, all of that. And hey, Al, by the way, you don't need to be a yes man to Bill Clinton anymore. Or, maybe you can advise him that vegan means not eating animals or animal secretions at all, anytime. That he can't eat, out of both sides of his mouth, as, it's a political speech where he would talk out of both sides of his mouth. He can't eat eggs and fish and call himself a vegan. He can't. And if you guys really want to blow some minds, not only can Clinton Gore eat like vegans, you can dress like vegans too. Imagine the headlines, huh? Clinton and Gore go vegan, vow to stop eating and wearing animals, including fur, leather, wool, and silk. You may have noticed the anti-fur demonstrations happening worldwide this past Friday. A day known as Fur Free Friday. Always a big demonstration in Beverly Hills, the scene of the crime, the center of the crime, really, with Death Row, or Death Row Deo Drive, with all the fur salons there. I wasn't able to make it this year. I'm in the Bay Area up north, but it does rekindle fond memories. Yes, the fond memories of being unconstitutionally arrested by Beverly Hills police for using a megaphone and taking a very inconvenient truth to the streets of Beverly Hills about the violence in the vanity for sale there. 40 dead animals, one fur coat. 40 dead animals, one fur coat. And no doubt, fur is very beautiful on the original owner, the animal, who has to be trapped or raised in horrific confinement, stomped, gassed, drowned, or anally electrocuted to take his or her fur, and it is his or her fur. Yes, fur is beautiful on the original owner. On you? I mean, let's face it, it's a fat and hairy look. I mean, if that's the look you want, great, but you don't need to wear fur. Just don't shave and, eat another cheeseburger, pepperoni pizza, whatever. I didn't encourage anybody to eat animal products just now, really. I didn't. And when you give the gift of fur, don't be surprised if your loved one expresses appreciation by saying, "Oh, honey, oh, bee vomit. Oh, honey, I didn't realize how much you don't care. You don't care about animals. You don't care about the environment. But honey, I understand. It's your lack of thought that counts. So I'm sorry. How could I not appreciate the gift of anal electrocution?" And such thoughtlessness creates an industry that murders about 50 million animals annually raised on fur farms around the world. This number, I mean, doesn't reflect poor rabbits, huh? How many rabbits are killed worldwide? Perhaps more than a billion a year? Rabbit fur is very popular in France, which means doom for about 70 million in that country every year. About lot of killing of mink. For shame, for shame. I mean, fur is a worldwide disgrace. Mink are murdered in astonishing numbers. Denmark is their greatest killer, 14 million. China, 12 million. Holland, almost 5 million. Poland kills over 4 million mink. And in the US, about 3.5 million die for no reason except for vanity. With over 1 million killed in Wisconsin, the Badger State. Great that the Badger Cull is ending in the UK. Maybe I'll get to that story today. So 85% of fur comes from fur farms. That means foxes, dogs, raccoons, chinchillas, mink. Trapping, you have the leg hold trap. Isn't that a wonderful invention? Where animals actually chew off their legs to try to escape, and then unintended animals wind up in the traps, dogs and cats. The intended animals, foxes, coyotes, bobcats, lynx, raccoons, and wolves, end up in the closet. In the closets of very uncaring people. And then don't forget, there are seal hunts in Canada and Namibia for fur, for fur shame. Fur is also an environmental disaster. A study by Gregory H. Smith of the University of Michigan estimated that it takes almost three times the energy to produce a fur coat from trapped animals than synthetic fur. And you get much toxicity with your vanity. Chromium and formaldehyde are used in the tanning process to prevent fur from rotting. Fur farms have been fined in the past by the EPA for noncompliance with hazardous waste measures. Waste, the EPA says, can cause respiratory problems for people and carcinogenic risk. Animal waste, high in phosphorus and nitrogen, can contaminate groundwater and streams. Excessive algae forms, killing fish. We mentioned chromium and formaldehyde in the tanning process. The process that stabilizes collagen in protein fibers in animal skins that stops them from biodegrading. Also used are mineral salts and coal tar derivatives, dyes, oils, finishes, some of which contain cyanide. And then additional waste includes other pollutants, acids and sulfides, protein, hair, lime sludge, salt. So it is common for groundwater near tanneries to be contaminated by cyanide, lead, formaldehyde. There are leukemia risks to the community, cancer risks to tannery workers. A New York State study found that more than half of testicular cancer victims worked at tanneries. Okay, so Fur-Free Friday is great, but, you know, what about all the other holiday shopping weekends? Wouldn't it be great if maybe a couple of people were to head out every weekend to Rodeo Drive or around fur salons and to educate people on what's wrong with fur? And what's wrong with fur is also wrong with leather and wool and silk, and we'll be looking at those unfashionable fashion faux pas in the holiday shopping weeks ahead here on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Oh, and this is a food show, right? And with it being Hanukkah, let's veganize typical Jewish foods today. We'll be talking to Jeffrey Cohan, the new executive director of Jewish Vegetarians of North America. Also coming up, the authors of Confronting Animal Exploitation, Kim Socha and Sarah Jane Blum. And Professor Gary Francione on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. GoVeganRadio.com, on Twitter at GoVeganRadio, and you can like Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, or you can dislike it. Doesn't matter to me, but please be my friend on Facebook. There are two Bob Linden pages. Maybe you can get in. They're both maxed out at 5,000, so I think I need to ask everyone to go to the Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden Facebook pages. So to have a vegan holiday, you may want to shop at Viva La Vegan Grocery. It's the world's largest vegan grocery with over 6,000 vegan items. That one in Rancho Cucamonga, 9456 Robert Street. And you can go to the website, which is VivaLaVeganGrocery.com. Order from there also. And Viva La Vegan recently opened in Santa Monica on Ocean Park in 28th. And it had been some sort of, pseudo-natural market prior to that, and its main selling point there was that it sold raw milk. And so when Viva La Vegan, the grocery opened there, the vegan grocery opened there, people were still showing up for raw milk. And Arlo, one of the owners, asked me to put a little something together for him related to raw milk, and somewhat timely. I see that Tennessee health officials just recently had to deal with an E. coli outbreak related to raw milk. So really, I mean, when you look at raw milk, it is the perfect food, right? But that's for baby cows. And people who want to grow horns and hooves and a tail and a stomach with four chambers and, put their family's health at risk. Got raw milk, got cancer. The dairy protein is the carcinogen to which Americans are most exposed, says Professor T. Colin Campbell of Cornell University and MIT, and of the China Study, the largest study of diet and health ever. Raw milk has been, quote, this country's number one food safety concern, end quote, and has regularly caused large outbreaks of deadly disease. Those were both quotes from the United States Centers for Disease Control, CDC. Okay. Raw milk has been this country's number one food safety concern and has regularly caused large outbreaks of deadly disease. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration warns that it is unsafe to eat raw milk or cream, soft cheeses such as brie and camembert, and Mexican-style soft cheeses such as queso fresco, and a number of them made from raw milk, yogurt made from raw milk, pudding made from raw milk, ice cream or frozen yogurt made from raw milk. That's the USDA saying, unsafe to eat. Raw milk from cows, sheep, or goats can carry dangerous bacteria, including Salmonella, E. coli, and Listeria, which are responsible for causing numerous foodborne illnesses, especially dangerous to children, pregnant women, the elderly, and those with compromised immune systems. Quote, the dairy farm environment, even when every precaution is taken, is a reservoir for illness-causing germs. From 1999 to 2008, 86 outbreaks related to raw milk were reported to CDC, leading to 1,676 illnesses, 191 hospitalizations, 2 deaths. That's about 8 outbreaks per year. Did you hear what the CDC said? The dairy farm environment, even when every precaution is taken, is a reservoir for illness-causing germs. Milk, little Johnny here? Would you like your glass? Raw milk is 150 times more likely to cause foodborne illnesses and results in 13 times more hospitalizations than illnesses involving pasteurized dairy products, the FDA says. And really, if you want raw milk, you can have raw almond milk, which is available at Viva La Vegan Grocery also. So that's the story on raw milk. Also, I invite you, if you are in the Bay Area, to visit Vegetarian House Vegan Restaurant, 520 East Santa Clara Street in San Jose, vegetarianhouse.us. It is a spectacular restaurant, and I'm here to convince you to go vegan and that you don't have to sacrifice any pleasure, and then no animals have to be sacrificed either. Vegetarianhouse.us. And if you're in the Bay Area, you might want to contact Vegetarian House for catering. If you have a corporate event coming up in the near future, a wedding, a bar mitzvah, a bris, I don't know what to tell you. We have the executive director of Jewish Vegetarians of North America coming up next to celebrate Hanukkah on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. GoVeganRadio.com. Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. Glad you could join us here. It is the holiday season. It seems that Hanukkah has come a little early this year, and just before we start to celebrate it with the new executive director of Jewish Vegetarians of North America, I'm reminded that quite often in Jewish households there is the celebration with a glass of Manischewitz wine, right? Manischewitz. And as we've talked about on this program, not all wines are vegan, and not all wines are organic. In fact, most wines are not vegan. Most wines are not organic. I don't really know about Manischewitz. But if you do really want to know, and if you are somebody who drinks wine, well, then you need to look into vegan organic wines, and you can go to the website veganwinesonline.com. Veganwinesonline.com. Then your wine can live up to your ideals also. And I would now like to welcome to Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, Jeff Cohan. He is the new executive director of the vegan advocacy group, Jewish Vegetarians of North America, a 38-year-old organization. And welcome, Jeffrey. Mazel tov on your new job.
Thank you, Bob. Malone Garten listener, and as I said in the talk, so it is first time caller, so great to be with you.
Thank you for being with us today. And we are right in the middle of Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah? What is the celebration of Hanukkah?
Well, Hanukkah commemorates the miracle of resurrecting the temple in Jerusalem after his act. But it's a celebration of light in a time of darkness in the northern hemisphere.
Mm-hmm. The celebration of light. Okay.
Celebration of light, because the main act of Hanukkah is lighting the menorah, one progressive candle each night. So by the eighth night, the menorah is fully lit and giving off the most light.
Mm-hmm. So, if I look at the Bible, the Bible the Torah, to which Jews are, it is their Bible. Right in the beginning, Genesis, in Genesis, book 1, verse 29, God basically says to be vegan, and my perspective is that the correct way to be Jewish is to be vegan. Genesis 1:29, and then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. This will be your food," period, end of sentence, end of discussion. How could any meat be kosher?
That's a great question. The laws of kashrut, if you really take a look at them, reflect deep moral concern with eating meat. And the laws of kashrut were designed to make meat eating a big pain in the tuchus, which is Yiddish for your derriere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the way it is. If you keep kosher, it is a big pain. And obviously the ideal form of kashrut is to be vegan. Because if you're vegan, then it's very easy to keep kosher.
Yeah. Okay. So, so you say it's difficult. It's a pain in the tuchus to keep kosher if you eat meat. Because, like, then what do you have to do? Why is it a pain?
Well, for one thing, you can only eat kosher meat, which is more expensive, and you can't get it everywhere. But what makes it even a bigger pain is you need to keep two separate dishes. At least two separate dishes, one for dairy, one for meat. And it's keeping it all separate, washing them separately, storing them separately, making sure you never eat one on the other. It is a big pain. It's complicated, and that's what it was designed to be, as a discouragement to eat meat in the first place.
Yeah, well, I always worry about cross-contamination. You know, I'd be concerned. You know, that's why their warnings come with poultry and concerns about cutting boards and knives and all of that. And I guess those present the same challenges to being kosher. But if you are vegan, then you are kosher?
Right. In a sense, you're de facto kosher, but veganism is the ideal form of being kosher.
Mm-hmm.
And if that wasn't the case, then our organization couldn't even exist.
Mm. And you've been around for now coming up almost 40 years, and now there have been some changes made. Is there a rededication to vegan advocacy now? You do advocate, it is vegan advocacy for you.
Correct. The organization is 38 years old, but just in the past 12 months or so, JVN has undergone a thorough reorganization and transformation. So it's a much more potent and capable organization than it's ever been. And we're very excited about that. And I think if you go to our website, jewishbeds.com, it reflects that transformation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I not to be stereotypical, but I don't think Jewish mothers would be offended if we look at them as people who care very deeply about their children, as all mothers do. Jewish mothers want their children to pretty much stay young forever, stay healthy forever, and yet feeding the kids meat, whether it be labeled kosher or not, you know, so flesh, dairy, eggs, fish, all of those things create an unhealthy Jewish community.
Right. And the fact is, and this has been the case for millennia, there's always been give and take between the Jewish community and the wider culture we have lived in. And basically, most Jews who keep kosher are just living a kosher version of the standard American diet. We know what that entails. But at JVNA, we're advocating a much better way to keep kosher and just a better way of life for Jews. It is, what we advocate is completely consistent with Jewish teachings.
Mm-hmm. Where did things go wrong? I mean, it is right in the beginning of the Bible to be vegan, to eat only what grows from the earth. And, you know, I mean, look at the rampant rates of heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes in the Jewish community. Where did it go wrong? When did it take the wrong direction?
Well, it took the wrong direction after the flood. Of course, I'm sure you're familiar with the story of Noah in the ark in the flood. God made a promise after the flood that he would not eradicate human beings again. But to do that, he had to make some concessions to human beings' baser nature, which included meat eating. So the Torah does allow meat eating under these very restrictive conditions that are known as the kosher law. So that's where it basically began to go wrong. And as I said in my blog, the meat eating heap, the Jews were given an inch and they took a mile and ate really more meat, far more meat than God ever intended. But what's interesting, if you look at the way meat eating is described in the Torah, it's clearly not God's preference. It describes it as a human lust, but it never is described as what God wants human beings to do. And that's why our organization stands on very solid theological ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's like, oh, so God promised not to eradicate humans, and it was like, oh, you're such a failure. Oh, you're going to wind up eating flesh. Oh, it wasn't like God said, hey, it's okay, or it's something you should do. It's like, oh, you're such a mess. I don't know what to do with you. It's like, I give up, you know. However, one is concerned that maybe God's changing his, her, or its mind related to eradication of humans, considering what meat eating is and dairy consumption are doing to the environment. The eradication, you know, promise, you know, may be taken back.
Well, it's interesting because if you look a little bit later on in the Torah, the Book of Numbers is an amazing story that most people don't know about, but it's really a remarkable story, where a group of the Israelites, this is when they're in the desert, sustained on manna, which is described as like coriander seed, it's clearly vegan, and a group of the Israelites started begging Moses for meat. They had meat in Egypt, they were getting sick of manna, and Moses went to God, and God said, okay, they want meat, I will give them meat till it's coming out of their nostrils. It's actually a quote from the Bible. And sure enough, God produced a strong wind, and quail rained down on the Israelite camp, and these meat-lusting Israelites gorged themselves on quail, and then almost immediately died in a plague. And it says in the Torah, these Israelites were buried in the graves of lust. So it could not be more clear, when it was up to God, and God was sustaining the Israelites in the desert after they left Egypt and before they got to Israel, they were on a vegan diet of manna.
You know, it's more like, I think it's like, it sounds like God said, all right, you want to eat meat? Go ahead, eat meat. See what happens. And then maybe the Jewish attorneys got a hold of it and said, hey, God said it's okay to eat meat. Kosher meat is fine. Here's the kosher butcher. We can make money. You know, you'll be the one who stamps it kosher, and we can make some money off of it or something. It's a very, you know, it's so clear, right, in Genesis 1, verse 29. So what your website offers us alternatives to traditional Jewish foods that one would think would contain animal products.
Right. And I'm just a perfect example, because the latke, the potato pancake, is the best known Hanukkah food. And we have a great vegan latke recipe on our website. And whether it's Passover or just making a challah, which is the loaf of bread that we eat on Shabbat, we have vegan recipes for that too. So any dish that you can think of that Jews are associated with Jewish dinners in the Jewish home, we have vegan version, great recipes on our website.
Right, and the website is jewishveg.com. Or I'm
right.
Changing it. You know, I'm lately I'm saying veg. Whenever I see veg, for some reason I've decided I want people to know it's vegan. So forgive me if for 1 second I say it's jewishveg.com, as in vegan. jewishveg.com, because I'm a little whoops. Well. Stay with me, Jeff Cohan, new executive director of the Jewish Vegetarians of North America. We will continue our discussion, talk a bit about Hanukkah and some of the recipes on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, and his website is jewishveg.com. GoVeganRadio.com, coming to you live every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time, now nationally syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network, and we're glad you can join us. We've expanded to 2 hours coming up shortly on the program. We will have a discussion of the book Confronting Animal Exploitation with its editors, Kim Socha and Sarah Jane Blum, and next hour, Animal Rights Commentary with Professor Gary Francione. Just in case you're interested, also, I've always said J-E-L-L, no, because, you know, Jell-O is made from gelatin, which is not cool. Cool cups are made from seaweed. They are vegan, GMO-free, fat-free, gluten-free, naturally low in calories, and now they are kosher, gelatin-free cool cups. We're talking today, it is Hanukkah, and we are talking to the new executive director of the Jewish Vegetarians of North America, a 38-year-old vegan advocacy organization, and you can veganize what are traditional Jewish foods, and I see your website has some amazing recipes. Everything looks really delicious here, Jeff. The website, Jewish Veg or Jewish Veg, jewishveg.com, just to let people know. You know, there has become confusion over the words vegan and vegetarian, and sometimes people think if you say vegetarian, it means you can have dairy or eggs or whatever, you know. So it's like we kind of have to emphasize the vegan advocacy part now, it seems.
Right. So in the film, we thought a lot about, yes, our name is Jewish Vegetarians of North America, and yes, we're a vegan advocacy organization. So why the discrepancy in names? And I know this is an issue you've discussed on your show, Bob. The issue is the research, as it stands right now, is pretty unequivocal. Meat eaters, which, of course, are the people we're trying to aim our message to, are much more responsive to the word vegetarian than the word vegan. So to get people to be receptive to our message, we do use the word vegetarians in our name. But if you look at our website, of course, all of the recipes are vegan. You'll find many references to veganism on other pages of the website as well.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I'm looking at the potato latkes right now. Let's see. This is a recipe from, one of the great vegan cooks, Isa Chandra Moskowitz. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And her post-punk kitchen. And, latkes look great. They're a very, they're a Hanukkah kind of tradition. 2.5 pounds of potatoes peeled, 1 onion yellow, 1/4 cup corn or potato starch, salt, matzo meal. That's pretty easy, Yeah. So what have been some of your favorite vegan foods? Let's see. What do you have here? There is also the I always thought that a vegan chopped liver kind of would be like something called, what do you think I am? Chopped liver? And it's that, right?
No, it's great because, my dad made a delicious chopped liver and then died of heart disease at age 52. And it was really because of his diet. And that is part of what inspires me to do the work I do. I've just seen so much needless death and illness among not only Jews, but all people from all walks of faith and life who are dying way too young because of their diets.
Mm-hmm.
So to offer these recipes that are much healthier and taste just as good, if not better, is a real blessing.
Right. And people need to understand, they often say, heart disease, it's in my genes, it's in the family, No, it was what the family was eating. It's the diet. It's like, look at all that chicken fat, it's look at what you're eating. And yet here you have a chopped liver spread under the recipes, jewishveg.com or jewishveg.com. Your ingredients, 3 tablespoons vegetable broth, 1/2 pound mushrooms chopped, a small onion chopped, 1 tablespoon of water, and 1 cup of chopped walnuts. What do you think this is, chopped liver? Hey, Jeff Cohen, thanks for being with us today. We really appreciate it, and good luck with your vegan advocacy now on your new job with the Jewish Vegetarians of North America.
Thank you so much, Bob. Big fan of your show, so I hope especially your Jewish listeners will support both your show and JVNHL.
Thank you so much. Take care, Jeff. Greetings once again. Welcome back for our second hour of Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. We have now expanded to 2 hours weekly, and we're heard live every Sunday between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. Pacific Time. You can support the radio program with a tax-deductible donation by going to goveganradio.com and clicking on Donate. You can also advertise your vegan and cruelty-free products and services. Email me. It's bob@goveganradio.com. And yes, we have to get working on getting the funding together so that we can be back on WWRL in New York City and WCPT in Chicago, 2 radio stations that carried the program when we were on Air America, and they want us back, but the way it goes in media today is since deregulation and consolidation is that we have to pay for radio airtime. We're also now nationally syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network, bringing you thoughts on veganism, animal liberation, environment. And right now, I would like to welcome back to the program the co-editors and contributors to the book Confronting Animal Exploitation, Grassroots Essays on Liberation and Veganism. We welcome back Kim Socha, PhD, author of Women, Destruction, and the Avant-Garde, a paradigm for animal liberation. She is, as I said, contributing editor to this book, currently working on another book related to animal liberation and atheism. And Kim is an English instructor and activist for animal liberation and drug policy reform. And you may remember Sarah Jane Blum on the program. She was the lead plaintiff, actually, in a lawsuit against Eric Holder challenging the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And she is the founder or co-founder of GourmetCruelty.com and a board member of Support Vegans in the Prison System and New York City's Empty Cages Collective. I should mention also that Kim is on the board of the Institute for Critical Animal Studies and the Animal Rights Coalition. And I welcome Kim and Sarah Jane back to the program. How are you doing today?
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Okay. We'll all three talk at once here so we can get it all in, you know? So tell us about, and you're both in Minnesota. This is really a book with, you know, kind of grassroots activists from the Minnesota area. Is that what we have here? Essays?
That's correct. It really is a book that is about how community can bring conversation to a level that the internet can't, and that, you know, like, even connections with people through magazines. It's funny because it's a book about how we need more than just books. You know, it's a book about how we all need to start talking to each other and marshaling the resources of our own individual communities. So it was a bunch of activists who do, you know, we don't all work together on the same campaigns, but we all work in the same community and look at the same struggle on the micro level, not just, you know, the same big fight that we're all in to, you know, stand up against animal exploitation, and as such kind of are able to dig down into conversations that you don't have with people who don't see the world from where you're standing.
Mm-hmm. And I saw you mentioned in the book that you talked to an activist who attended the national conferences, and he, I guess, was frustrated with them. And the question was, well, why still go to them when it's the same people talking about things, you know, about which many of us don't even relate anymore? But I guess the response was it's the discussions in the hallways, you know, kind of the grassroots activism. So maybe you want to take us on a tour through the book and some of the essays, some of the writers of the essays, and what some of the thoughts are. And I don't know, Kim, Sarah Jane, you take it.
This is Kim. I'm sorry I dropped the call for a moment or two, so I'm a little behind. But I can hear you both now, and I could give you a little tour of the book, as you had said. Basically, it's divided into four sections. It really is a mix of some academic essays, some narratives. We really wanted to get a wide variety of perspectives as far as what people wanted to talk about, whether it was their personal struggles in marriage or issues with families and parenting, their two, again, more academic essays that look at why capitalism isn't more commonly challenged in the animal rights dialogues, and some that target very specific campaigns, such as Humane Society with United Egg Producers. One author talks specifically about the Shack 7 case. So as I've heard Sarah Jane put it before, which I really like, is, you know, it's wonderful if people read the whole book, of course, but there's really a little something in there for people approaching, whether they're new to the movement or just need a little boost. There's kind of something for everyone to pick from. We even have a oral history of the Animal Rights Coalition, on which I'm the board, which is the oldest grassroots group in the United States. So there really is a wide perspective of ideas and writing styles in the book.
I noticed that, and it covers everything from the personal level to national campaigns. Basically, it really
and
does
even to Stephen King's literature. There's a literary analysis for animal liberation, and how we can use popular literature to explore these issues of animal liberation. We kind of got a sprinkling of everything in there.
There's two essays on literary analysis because they're the story. The question of vegan parenting centrals a lot on the question of how to deal with media exposure that your children get, whether or not you want them to.
Right, how speciesist media exposure is, right? I mean, it's just indoctrination, even on Sesame Street, I see it mentions here. <so.
laughs> that's a lot about why the book is so wide-ranging in its essays, because we all are brought to this movement because we see speciesism every day, but we all see it, in different aspects of our lives. We all see it, we all see it from the positions that, we find ourselves in. If you work in a vegan shop, you're going to see a lot less issues surrounding the egg industry than if you work at Whole Foods every day. And that's why we tried to get a lot of activists who don't do a lot of writing to go, God, this is what I want to talk about. This is what I wish people were talking about more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. We talk about how people, right from the start of the book, how people turn away from our issues, the frustrations of we're trying to reach people with the most important issues of our time. What could save us from climate change? What could save billions of animals? And we're frustrated because people turn away.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the starting essay in here. So we're talking to Kim Socha and Sarah Jane Blum, the co-editors of Confronting Animal Exploitation, Grassroots Essays on Liberation and Veganism. And what were your specific writings that you contributed?
I'm gonna let Kim go first. She did more.
Oh, okay. I did two. One is called Just Tell the Truth, a polemic on the value of radical activism, which it explains the somewhat of an anti-capitalist approach, but also looks at the value of being radical and what it really means, and that it's not a word to shy away from. And then I also wrote a chapter called The Dreaded Comparisons and Speciesism, Leveling the Hierarchy of Suffering, to discuss the limits of using trans-species analogies, like slave trade analogies, genocide and Holocaust, in order to, try to wake people up to the truth about animal exploitation, suffering, and death. And what I try to do is just analyze if those are beneficial and really how they've generally been misguided and possibly offensive in the past. So those were my main contributions.
On the dreaded comparisons, so what was your opinion of them, like in comparisons to slavery and the Holocaust and all? Your conclusion is...
What it comes down to is, I think the term I use is they're not fast food activism. They're things that you have to approach people with very cautiously, maybe have a reading list ready to give them. It's not something that at a protest I would feel comfortable. Other people have different methods. Yelling, you support slavery, or this is a Holocaust, let's say I was at a protest outside of First Store, I would think that that would be a way to maybe disenfranchise potential people to hearing our message if we're throwing out terminology such as that without having time to contextualize it. So I find that they can be problematic unless they're done very carefully in a more kind of intimate one-on-one setting.
Yeah,
and generally that they should also be done by people who have that cultural history to draw upon. So as a white woman, I don't feel comfortable making the slavery analogies.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I certainly understand and see the comparisons and see how they can be helpful if thoughtfully presented. I mean,
And that's basically what I conclude. It's not like a monumentous conclusion that I come to, but I basically say I do think they can work, but they have to be thoughtful.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, I feel like it's a microcosm of the whole book. That, mm-hmm. you know, that what works as one tactic or in one location is not going to work for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So we will come back and continue our discussion with Kim Socha and Sarah Jane Blum. Professor Gary Francione coming up later in the hour. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. GoVeganRadio.com. Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, GoVeganRadio.com. On Twitter, at GoVeganRadio. Today, we're talking to Kim Socha and Sarah Jane Blum. They are editors and contributors to the very interesting book called Confronting Animal Exploitation, Grassroots Essays on Liberation and Veganism. And were you about to tell us about your contribution to the book, Sarah Jane?
I was. I think, in a nutshell, what I tried to discuss was what I learned in the almost two decades that I've been working, you know, on animal issues. And what I've learned is I've made more mistakes than I can count, and I probably will make more mistakes than I could imagine. And that,
look, you came on this radio show, so.
I'm hoping that's not going to be one of them. But
okay. I didn't know. Okay.
But no, I mean, what I mean is, you know, I had all these assumptions when back in 1996, when I first really thought about the fact that I could be a voice for change, I had all these assumptions about what the world would look like in 2013. And, you know, I have to say, in some ways, I did not expect the word vegan to be as prominent as it is. I certainly didn't believe that there would be something called Go Vegan Radio that I would be fortunate enough to be on. You know, but I also expected that I would not be worrying about racism, sexism, you know, homophobia within the community of activists I worked with. So I think a lot about just how we can remain thoughtful and use our mistakes when we do make them on a personal level or on a movement level to continue to go forward in a way that, you know, feels true to the compassion that leads us to become animal activists in the first place.
Well, I noticed you used the words liberation and veganism on the cover. At least you didn't say vegetarian and welfare. So that's refreshing. and I know there's a lot
design,
of
there's
a lot of criticism in the book of a lot of the large organizations who seem to have gone astray. The organizations who appointed themselves leaders of a cause, and you know they're misleading us. But Sarah Jane, it should be mentioned that you are a heroic figure, though, for challenging Eric Holder and the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act in court. It was dismissed because you didn't have standing. Was that?
Well, I will say that is the government's argument. It's actually in appeal right now. The oral appeal will be heard within the next couple of months. I would say that, you know, it's completely farcical to say that because we cannot prove that I am being chilled, because we cannot
because we cannot prove all the things that I did not do because I was too afraid to do them, which is basically the basis of the lawsuit, this idea that the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act has made people afraid to speak their mind or, you know, act out when they see injustice. The fact that I could not show more than, you know, more ways in which I was silenced means I don't have standing. It's really just it's a little Kafka-esque is the only way to put it. And that is why it is going to appeal. And hopefully in the appeal, it will be proven that, you know, to start saying that you can't bring suit about a chilling effect because you have been too chilled is not going to like a healthier democracy.
Yes, and people should know that through the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, there's a special terrorist category for direct action activists who somehow may harm the profits of an animal enterprise. It's also vague and confusing. In fact, this radio show is probably a violation of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. So, I would say
that Thanksgiving, when you did not eat a turkey, and if you went to a Thanksgiving where somebody did not buy a turkey because they wanted you to feel comfortable, that is a violation of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act.
Right. We hurt the profits of butt hairball turkey. So we may have, I don't know, do we have a minute or two left? I don't know. Any closing thoughts that we might have here or how to get the book or say something? Or
I'm going to steal something from Sarah Jane because I like when she has said this before is that, of course, and I hope you don't mind Sarah Jane, but we want people to buy the book and read it, be inspired by it, have questions about it, but we also would love to see other books like this from other grassroots groups because we are just a small contingent of people.
We're out of time. Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. Thanks for support from Kim Sheridan, author of the heartwarming award-winning book Animals and the Afterlife. Visit animalsandtheafterlife.com. You can support this program with a tax-deductible donation at goveganradio.com. Just click donate, and while you're there, you have hundreds of free archives that you can hear, including past programs with my two guests, Kim Socha and Sarah Jane Blum, authors of Confronting Animal Exploitation, Grassroots Essays on Liberation and Veganism. Kim left us with her parting thought, and Sarah Jane, I wanted to spend another minute with you with your final thoughts here, and let us know, when do you think there will be some resolution with you in the court case related to the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act?
I'm hoping that the resolution will come within the next few months, but like everything else, in as big a bureaucracy as the American legal system, it slowly and at its own pace. For my parting words, the thing that I would like to say that I think speaks to my experience in the lawsuit and to my experience writing the book and editing the book and also my experience doing the work of confronting animal exploitation is that it's okay that we feel scared when we take on big challenges. It's on purpose that the industries we are fighting try to silence us through fear. And it's okay to feel that fear. And we should all be proud every time we stand up to it and speak our minds and do what we can to make the world a better place, whether it feels small at the time or huge. Because in the past 20 years, I've seen a lot of things that I thought were going to be huge end up being small, and a lot of things that I thought were going to make a small change snowball into huge changes in culture. So thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you so much, Sarah Jane. I appreciate it. And now I can be proud of the stage fright I have every week before doing this show. So I'm nervous. I want to represent the animals. I want everybody to go vegan. I want to say the exact thing that would make people go vegan. So thanks so much, Sarah Jane. Perhaps I can't do it, but maybe Professor Gary Francione can. I mean, he's had a lot of experience being the first academic to teach animal rights theory in an American law school, that being Rutgers University, and his website is abolitionistapproach.com. And he has a new book, Eat Like You Care, an examination of the morality of eating animals. How are you today, Professor Francione?
I'm very, very well, Mr. Linden. How are you? Do you really get stage fright when you do your show every week?
I do. I'm nervous about it. I'm nervous every time I speak in public. And I was nervous every time when I was in radio. I did a music show every day, and you know, every day there's just something. We fight our fears. Like, what if my mind just goes completely blank and I have?
Yes, suppose that's always the problem. What happens? Completely blank. Yes.
Or if the record ends and there's no more music to play. Yes. You know, like I have dreams still at night. The record's ending. I don't have another record to play. So far so good for 12 years though.
That's pretty good, Bob. You're doing a great job. I thought tonight I would talk a little bit about the necessity of theory. Now, I don't want to bore people, but look, we've got to be real here. There's a really anti-intellectual strain amongst many animal advocates. They think that somehow if you read a book or if you think about theory, you're somehow not engaging in action, and that's bad because you're ivory tower. You can't be academic. You can't be theoretical. You've got to do. You've got to engage in action, and sitting around and thinking or reading or analysis like that. That's just a big waste of time. And I have to tell you, that's not only wrong, but it is completely wrong, and it's destroying the movement. Let me explain. You know, I've been doing this work now for 32 years, and I very rarely meet animal rights people who do much reading. The dead giveaway is the number of times I've had people say to me, look at me with astonishment when I say, well, Peter Singer does not maintain that animals have rights. Indeed, he rejects the concept of moral rights as a utilitarian. And people look at me and they say, does he? Does he do that in Animal Liberation? And I always follow up and say, have you read Animal Liberation? Well, and the answer is no. A lot of people have Animal Liberation. They haven't read Animal Liberation. And the bottom line is that animal rights people don't like to read things. They don't like to, I put up these blog essays. I didn't really want to start the blog, the abolitionistapproach.com. I didn't want to do it, and people said, you got to do it because, you know, that's how people understand and learn these days. They read blog essays. And so I start putting up blog essays, and I get people saying, can't you make them shorter? And so you get to the point where, you know, if you can't put theory in a tweet, people don't want to read it or can't read it. And, you know, if it's, it's appalling. And I really think this is pushing us in the wrong direction. Look, we need theory. If we're going to know what actions to take, we need theory to tell us what actions we're going to take. Because if we don't, Bob, what we end up doing is just following along with the status quo, which is itself representative of a theory, just the wrong one. So if we don't know about theory and we haven't thought about theory and we want to do things, what do we end up doing? We end up doing what the large groups tell us to do. So we end up going along with what HSUS or Mercy for Animals or Farm Sanctuary or PETA or the RSPCA, whatever these organizations tell us to do, that's what we do. And those organizations all represent a theory, the theory of animal welfare, the theory that it is all right to use it, it's all right to use animals. The primary problem is you have to treat them well. And basically, that's the position they all take, more or less. There are differences. Some emphasize different, some think we need to go further than others. But they're all focused on treatment because they're all reflecting the theory of animal welfare that developed in the 19th century, that's reflected in the work of Peter Singer. They're all following along with that. So if you're an advocate and you want to get involved, you want to do something, and you're not going to really worry about the fine points, you're not going to read anything, you're not going to care about theory, you're not going to care about the philosophy of it, you just want to get involved with, well, what you're going to get involved with, the action that you're going to get involved with is going to be undertaken by an organization that itself is reflecting the theory. The only problem is it's the wrong theory. So I really think this idea that we don't need theory, that it's just a matter of action, is, I think, deadly. I think it is devastating. I think it is one of the reasons why the movement is dead in the water now. I had a very interesting experience this week. The badger call in Britain was called off, and it was called off because the people that they hired, the Marx persons that they hired to shoot these badgers, weren't killing enough badgers. So the government called off the call.
What's the need for a badger call?
The need, interestingly, Bob, the need for a badger call is the badgers apparently communicate bovine tuberculosis to cows. Cows that we're going to eat. So we've got to protect the cows we're going to eat by shooting the badgers. And so the animal advocates in Britain formed a coalition. They had, the coalition basically was being led by the RSPCA and your favorite organization, Humane Society International, amongst other large welfareist groups, International Fund for Animal Welfare and whatnot. But these are organizations, Bob, as you know, Humane Society International has its own Happy Meat label, the Humane Choice label. The RSPCA actively promotes the consumption of animal foods, of meat, of dairy, of everything through its Freedom Food label. These are organizations that are peddling death. These are organizations that promote the consumption of meat, dairy, eggs, everything else. They have their own happy exploitation labels. And animal advocates got together with these people, basically in the lead, in this anti-call campaign. The call was, as I said, ultimately stopped because they weren't shooting enough badgers.
A lot of the cages were stolen, too. I think like 100, you know, there were many. Set out a lot of traps.
And there are folks who are, you know, I mean, the before the call, there were a number of people, including biologists and wildlife people, who were predicting that if they needed to use traps for a short period of time, rather than a longer call in which they were actually shooting, at large badgers, as it were, the free running badgers, that was going to be something where they wouldn't get enough animals, and that's the way that they proceeded to have the call, and they ended up not having the numbers. Now, there are people who are claiming that the reason why the call was stopped was because of the hunt sabs, etc. And, you know, look, I mean, I don't know what the role of the hunt sabs was, but the bottom line is that I'm glad the call stopped. But the bottom line is it was a disaster of a campaign because it had nothing to do with animal rights. The whole campaign was predicated on the fact that it was bad science, which it was. I mean, it really was. It's silly to think that that you're going to do anything about bovine tuberculosis through a badger call for lots of different reasons. However, the government says they're going to do it next year, so because they've got a 4-year license. But the bottom line is. So I raised this issue with people, and I said, forming coalitions with the RSPCA and Humane Society International is a really bad idea. And the response that I got was, well, we've got to do something. That sort of begs the question about what it is that you do, because, you know, you might decide you're going to put your resources into dealing with the fact that every night, every day and night in London, they're killing thousands and thousands, they're poisoning thousands and thousands of rats, many more than the badgers that they're killing. But, I mean, you know, so what you choose is a whole...
the bad side and the good side of living in a world where there's a huge amount of animal exploitation is that there are a lot of different targets for you to choose, a lot of different things for you to focus on.
I hear the music, which says we need to take a break, but we will continue with Theory and Professor Gary Francione on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. On Twitter, at goveganradio, because that's what people care about, if I can get something in 144 characters. For me too, Gary, I write something long on Facebook, nobody's interested, but if it's a line or two, like on Twitter, then the likes and the retweets all happen. We're talking to Professor Gary Francione. We were talking about, well, there was the cull going on in the UK. Cull is another one of those words. Doesn't it hide like it's a massacre, that it's a mass killing?
I'm delighted the cull stopped for whatever reason it stopped. But I just think that this whole idea, we've got to be very careful as animal advocates. We have to be very careful of this idea that we just got to do something without thinking about what it is we're doing. Because unfortunately, I think that that campaign probably had the effect, given that we had the RSPCA, we had the other welfare groups leading that campaign with very strong welfarist rhetoric. My guess is the message that's gotten out to people is it certainly hasn't planted seeds of abolitionist thinking or vegan thinking. What it's done is it's planted seeds of welfarist thinking, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people in Britain who are delighted with the RSPCA because of the position they took on the badger cull, and they now feel comfortable and they trust the RSPCA more so that they'll look more favorably at things like freedom food. I don't think that's a positive thing. I think that's counterproductive. And I just think that animal people need to understand something. We can't avoid theory. You're either going to think for yourself and be critical about animal exploitation, or you're either going to read and consider theory and come to your own conclusions, whatever they are, or you're going to buy into the theory that is being reflected in the large organizations, all of which promote a welfarist idea.
Have the same talking points too. I just saw a speech by Compassionate World Farming. Basically HSUS talking points with a British accent.
It really is the British version of HSUS. And you're right, Bob. They all have the same talking points. They're all promoting
higher welfare. Higher welfare, by the way. Higher welfare.
And even the organizations that sort of think of themselves as more radical, the Mercy for Animals, the PETAs and the farm sanctuaries and whatnot, they're all promoting. They're all basically saying, you know, that they're talking about we've got to attack the worst abuses as if you can really talk about that coherently. It's all an abusive system. You can't get rid. I mean, when you're talking about getting rid of the worst abuses, you're suggesting that there's a way to make this better. There isn't. I don't care whether the slaughterhouse is approved by Temple Grandin or not approved by Temple Grandin. Temple Grandin, who received an award from PETA. I don't really care. All slaughterhouses are hellholes. They're all hideous places where animals spend the last moments of their lives in amidst hideous squalor, noise, terror, fear. And so the idea that, well, you know, some of these places are better than nonsense. The idea that there's an abusive or non-abusive way to do these things, nonsense. It's all abuse. And all of these organizations promote the same theory. So either you're going to have to, you know, I mean, if you're interested in animal ethics and you're interested in the question of what are our moral obligations to animals, you're going to have to do one of two things. You're going to have to figure that out yourself by reading, by thinking, by studying, or you're going to buy into the theory that's on offer. And if your position is, well, I've got to do something today, what you're going to end up doing is taking what's on offer from one of the large organizations, and that's going to be some welfarist, higher welfare, let's attack the worst abuses campaign, and as far as I'm concerned, that's worthless. No, I won't say it's worthless. It's actually worse than worthless. I think it's counterproductive. I don't think it's just futile. I think it's counterproductive.
Counterproductive, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. And you know even how I feel about the word welfare, because it seems to overstate things so much, it drives me crazy. It's almost like,
it's a technical. When we say animal welfare, we're not using it the same way that we use welfare when we talk about human welfare. It's a technical term which reflects a theory. This is Bob, you brilliantly illustrated. Animal welfare is a word that reflects a theory of humane use.
And then humane becomes a problematic word in that case, too. We're out of time. We'll have to pick up with it next week. I guess you'll be on in the first hour next week. Thanks, Professor Gary Francione. Thanks for listening. Go to the website, make a donation, listen to archives. GoVeganRadio.com.